My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. We've a cracking episode this week with author and investigator Dr. Irina Scott discussing her latest book, Sacred Corridors. As books on ufology go, this is easily one of the best I've ever read. It's informative, incredibly well researched and fantastically sourced. Yet before we dive in, it seems that once again the official stance on unexplained aerial phenomena, or UAPs as they're now known, has taken a turn again after Pentagon officials admitted in an interview with the New York Post that they were still investigating such sights and experiences of witnesses after denying doing so for years. For me, there seems to be a real momentum occurring, and this has been over the last 18 months, since the New York Times expose in December 2017. I've never understood the modern dogmatic stance of science to ignore such testimony. It seems to fly in the face of what science is supposed to do. But then again, you can also apply this to cryptozoology and parapsychology, and one can only hope that we continue to question and search for answers in these fields. When you hear witnesses on podcasts such as Monsters Among Us, Somewhere in the Skies or Into the Fray, these people are compelling, frightened and emotional. They come from all walks of life, and they deserve our respect for coming forward. It's a brave thing to do in the modern era. We all can think of examples where people have been absolutely destroyed, both online and in the media, for coming forward with such experiences. Also, I just wanted to say thank you so much for some of the lovely comments and feedback I've received for the show so far. It really does mean a lot to hear that both listeners and the guests are enjoying being part of Mysteries and Monsters, so thank you very much for the kind words. It really does mean a lot, and it makes all the time, effort and research I do worth every second. So thank you very much. Don't forget to leave us nice reviews on whichever medium you're using to listen to us these days. You can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean and YouTube, as well as follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. You can also sign up for Patreon to support us for just $1 a month and get early access to our weekly episodes. And from next month, we'll be doing bonus episodes as I dive into some spookier stories just for Patreon listeners. Right, so that's all from me. Let's join Dr. Irina Scott as we search for some smoking guns at Wright-Patterson Airfield, inside Project Blue Book and beyond. I am joined today by author Dr. Irina Scott to discuss her new book, Sacred Corridors. Dr. Scott has an extensive resume, both academically and in working for the Defence Intelligence Agency and the Aerospace Centre in satellite photography, as well as being a volunteer astronomer at Ohio State University. Dr. Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, Sacred Corridors, the book I've thoroughly enjoyed reading it from cover to cover. I find it a fascinating collection of evidence, anecdotes, stories. What gave you the idea to pull all this together? Because obviously you've worked in this field for a little bit in your own time. So what was the catalyst to go forwards from here?
Well, what catalyzed this particular book was that I know people that had worked for Project Blue Book, and one person had given me a lot of information several years ago, for some reason I hadn't used it yet. And then I found out that there would be a Project Blue Book program on the History Channel, a series. Yeah. And so I decided that's a good time to put everything together and try to write it up. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem quite interesting that Blue Book is back in the news, because it seems to have kind of lost favour sort of in the noughties, and it seems to be back as a relevant topic again over the last couple of years.
Yes, there hasn't been a lot of work done like that done on UFOs. I mean, so far as formal government investigations, until recently in a Time article in 2017, they reported about the ATIP program, that there was an actual program, the Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program, that was where they investigated UFOs, and I think that sparked interest in other government investigations.
Yeah. I think having seen several of the episodes, because it's only just aired over here in the UK, so we're a couple of months behind, because obviously I know it obviously premiered in the States first. I was really impressed by the level of production in the programme and how they've gone about it. Now, I know a lot of people have started criticising the way that they've romanticised some of the backstory and kind of created this drama template underneath it all. But in essence, the core subjects of each individual episode are well recorded.
Yeah, and for example, my book tells a lot of detail about what actually happened. They're dramatized, but people can look it up in books and other information on the History Channel and find out what really went on.
Yeah. I mean, do you think in regards to Blue Book, I mean, obviously what we know in the last couple of years, since you referred to the Leslie Keene article that broke in December 17, which I find quite odd that seemed to be the first real attempt by the authorities to say, actually, there are strange things going on and we're not really sure what's happening. And it seems to have kind of washed over a lot of people, which I find extremely peculiar.
Yes, I think it's pretty odd that the government claims they haven't been investigating, because they always said this is what they're investigating is a threat to national security. Well, if they were really interested in threats to national security, they would definitely be keeping track of what's going on with UFOs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always been of the opinion that in regards to UFOs or UAPs or whatever they, you know, you want to label the subject, that I think an admittance by any government authority that strange things are just coming and going as they please would be a matter of national security, regardless of which country it refers to. And I think that's probably had a lot to do with the kind of ridicule that's kind of preceded the last two, three years, where it's kind of come more across to being, actually, we are taking an interest in these and we always have.
Yes, I think that probably after Blue Book closed, I had the feeling that maybe they just went underground with the investigation and it became a lot more secret.
Do you think that was because, I mean, clearly it was a deliberate ploy, not necessarily to throw people off the scent, but I find it remarkable, because as you refer to there, everybody thinks Blue Book closed in, what was it, 1970? They shut the book on it, and as far as the American government were concerned, that was that. But now it's quite clear that they continued, and they've branched out into different things, and obviously they, you know, used Bigelow quite a lot in regards to some experiments and investigations. So, do you think that was a deliberate ploy just to kind of get on with a bit more in-depth work on the subject?
Yes, because I think in the case of Blue Book, there was a top secret study going on, and it was leaked. And then after that, the whole thing just seemed to disappear. And they used sort of fake investigations, for example, the Condon report, to say that there's nothing to it. Well, that report couldn't even identify one third of their data, so it wasn't a scientific report at all. It was more of a political report or something for the public.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, because it seems to me right now that we're on the cusp of something strange either being admitted to or coming out. What's your feelings about, because there seems to be a kind of momentum going on for anybody that's interested in ufology or extraterrestrial life or something. It just seems like there's a lot going on, and it hasn't seemed to be like this for quite a long time.
Well, I think in general that people are getting a different opinion, because back when UFOs first started, we didn't even have a space program. What we'd done is blown up atomic bombs, and then we got into space ourselves, and that made people think maybe other beings are out there. But then recently, they've discovered all kinds of planets, that the universe not only has stars, but it's full of planets too. And I think that makes more people wonder that if we're here, why isn't somebody else out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even if you, I mean, Arthur C. Clarke once famously said, there are two trains of thought when it comes to extraterrestrial life, that either there are other beings out there in the universe, or we are entirely alone, and both theories are equally terrifying.
Yes, and I guess so. Weird if we were the only beings in the vast, vast universe.
Very true. And like you're saying, you know, you refer to there, that the continual discovery of exoplanets and the further advance of space knowledge and our continued search for any sign of life out there, it seems to be something new gets discovered every other week at the moment.
Yes, and they have methods for finding the size and weight and different things of planets way across the galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still, I know it's been publishing photos for a very long time, but every time I see something new from Hubble, it still takes my breath away.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, in regards to Blue Book, I mean, the one outstanding thing I have in regards to your latest book is that it is so in-depth and follows trails to their logical conclusion, or at least goes down to a certain path. Would you say that it's that kind of subject that once you go in there with an open mind and look for these smoking guns, doors begin to open in a kind of domino effect after that?
Yes, because there was a lot of mystery that's still associated with Project Blue Book. It's not, everything about it isn't known. For example, I worked at Battelle Memorial Institute, and they did a study for Project Blue Book that had started out being top secret. And there was a leaker, is how people found out about it.
Yeah.
But there's mysteries with that. For example, nobody knows who did the study, for one thing. Surprisingly, there were no authors listed on it.
I mean, why? I mean, that's what's always mystified me. If your intention is to discredit a train of thought, or, you know, as you refer to in the book, in the early days, the authorities' opinion of it was that everybody was hallucinating, which I find, you know, 70 years on, absolutely baffling that anybody could kind of just, you know, just make it a one-size-fits-all excuse for the wide variety of sightings post the Arnold incident. But mm-hmm. you also refer to the fact that the Arnold sighting was probably the first mainstream media acceptance of it, because we know that there were situations prior to that. There were hundreds of accounts during the Second World War from pilots on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think made the Arnold incident sort of the touchstone for it to just go boom overnight, essentially?
Well, the objects he saw, he described them well, and he was a very well qualified pilot. The airplane he flew was difficult to fly, and he was used to flying through the mountains, which was also a difficult feat. And he tried to take real good measurements so that he was able to, he knew where the mountains were and how far away they were and that sort of thing. And due to that, he was able to estimate a speed for the objects and a visual look at them and things like that. He saw, for example, which mountains they went behind, and he was able to describe them really well. At the time, nobody had ever heard of UFOs from outer space, and what he was thinking was that they were some kind of guided missile or something from the United States at first. But that was a real good report. And then shortly after that, there were other reports of similar objects, including from a commercial airline with the pilot and the co-pilot and other people seeing things that looked pretty much the same. And I think that was a little more concrete than the Foo Fighters and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think it's always interesting as well, because obviously, as I've said to a couple of other people I've spoken to about this subject, whenever, or certainly still goes on, but I don't think it's as bad as it used to be, whenever this subject now comes up, there are usually three things that are usually mentioned by news organisations, which are little green men, tinfoil hats, and the X-Files theme. And it's like a standard template for any news report about anything strange. But more often than not, the media seems to reference itself in regards to explanations of what people have seen. And I've always found that quite peculiar.
I think it's because the government set those ideas through debunkers in Blue Book, where somebody saw something that looked like a craft that landed in their yard or something. The Blue Book would say, oh, you saw Venus, and laugh at them. And I think that sort of set that trend to ridicule the observations.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of reports from the 50s, Hopkinsville and Chestnut Ridge, where, having read the reports, because I've seen a couple of documentaries about both of them, and when you look into the case, the media reports of what the actual witnesses saw within 24 hours had completely been altered. I think Hopkinsville especially went from being, you know, the eyewitness report to little green men, and basically completely destroyed the people, you know, going back to the typical disrespectful view of a potential eyewitness.
Yeah, and some of that happened to people that were poor mountain people type. And so the media just went right ahead, and the government and slaughtered them. They said, and everything else, even though there wasn't any reason to say that, because they were fearful, they were trying to report something, and something bad happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing as well. I know the obvious skeptical response to most eyewitness sightings is eyewitnesses are unreliable. So I'm always kind of perturbed that we're expected to trust people in authority in every other aspect of our lives unless they see something unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, like if you see a car accident and give a report that this blue car ran into this, crossed the lane and ran into a red car and all that, well, people believe you. But if you say, well, I saw a UFO at treetop level come down over a lake and go back up, well, then they say, no, you didn't see that, even though it might be the same person. Because saying that couldn't happen.
Yeah, very true. Very true. So, obviously, your experience and interest in the subject started at a very early age. So, as you grew, did you find that your academic career gave you the opportunity to start to build on your personal interest in this subject?
No. From when I was a very young child, I wanted to be an astronomer. And I studied that and majored in it in college and looked for jobs. I had no chance at all of getting a job because every place I applied to said, this is male only. And so I never got into astronomy, and that gave me an opinion of science that isn't very logical, because why should they keep all the females out? I mean, why should they judge people on, you know, what they look like instead of their ability?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in judging someone entirely on the content of their character and that alone.
Yeah. Instead of saying no females.
Well,
so I wasn't too impressed with scientific logic from the start.
Absolutely. So, but you know, with the greatest of respect, you didn't let it put you off, and you've continued to develop your own knowledge base. Was that down to being told that, you know, as a woman, you weren't relevant or had anything to offer?
Well, I went into scientific research, but I didn't get into the field I wanted to get into. But I had a fair amount of publications and everything, and followed scientific method in the work.
Yeah, I mean, that's that your academic background is easy to see in the book because of the level of referencing and cross-pollination of ideas from chapter to chapter, which I find thoroughly engaging, because it really gives you so many tangents to follow up on top of the book that's included, which I find fascinating, that you extensively look at certain subjects, but you also give the reader the opportunity to, you know, just go after something. Was that a deliberate kind of plan when you began to draft the book?
Well, my experience in writing has been scientific papers, and I'm trying to write more for the public in this. But I think a lot of UFO writers are journalists and that sort of thing. And I have completely different training, where you have to document everything you say. And so I write like a scientific paper too, instead of like a journalist would write.
Yeah, I mean, I like I say, I love the way the book's set out, and I have to say, I was absolutely blown away by the Hynek communications. I just find them incredible.
Well, I did too. I had sat on those letters for some time, and I thought these were really amazing, but I hadn't done anything, and so I finally had the opportunity to get him in a book. And he was, I mean, I thought he was, well, ever since I was a kid, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, where he lived, and he wrote an astronomy column back then. And I had followed that, practically everything he said, and quoted it to everybody that would listen. He was sort of a hero before I thought about him in connection with UFOs. But so I was really interested in him, and had kind of followed him, but the letters really added something, because they were in handwriting and they were informal, whereas all the rest of his writings that have been quoted in books and stuff are formal things. And so the real essence of Dr. Hynek came through in those letters, and I was very happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, it certainly gives a whole new side to him, like you say, because I think most people are quite familiar with him as quite a formal gentleman when he's, you know, whenever you've seen any of the interviews that he gave, both on television or radio at the you know, throughout that era. And it seems to not necessarily knock the rough edges off him, because I don't think he ever came across as that type of chap. But I think the letter I enjoyed that made me smile the most was the one where he's advising someone how to deal with Philip Klass, which made me chuckle greatly.
Yeah, and he just did that in about one sentence, but it was a very, very, very meaningful sentence, because the person had written up a report on the coin helicopter sighting. Mm. And I had heard the interview. In fact, I was there at the radio station part of the time. And Philip Klass, well, there was the coin was helicopter sighting was where these people had a UFO come over their helicopter and shine a bright green light on the helicopter so that it lit up the instrument panel and everything, but it also even lit up the ground, and there were ground witnesses about it. Mm. And Phil Klass said, and then also the other thing was is that they were almost headed for a crash. They went to they didn't know what the thing was, and they started avoiding it and going down. And then suddenly they just gained a whole lot in altitude, but nobody realized it. And so Phil Klass had said, well, that's just a meteor going by, which didn't make any sense at all. But Hynek said, yeah, and what about when you know, gained all this speed and altitude? That was not a meteor. And he just said it in one sentence, but it really had a lot of impact on the investigation.
Very true. I think the first time I became aware of who Philip Klass was when I saw a program discussing the disappearance of Frederick Valentech, the Australian pilot. And Klass basically said, oh yeah, he's a drug runner, and he probably could, he was flying the plane upside down. Now, I found that both ludicrous and offensive, you know, because as the saying goes, you can't libel the dead. And I thought it was extremely disrespectful to his family, who, if you've ever seen any interviews, and I'm sure you have, or anywhere about with his family. I mean, his father was absolutely devastated. You know, I think I saw him just interviewed before he died in the early noughties. And his dad, you know, it had been almost 30 years. His father was still absolutely devastated by the loss of his son. Mm. And the recording of that journey is simply terrifying, because he's clearly interacting with some object around him. Klass said that he was flying the plane upside down. The plane that the pilot was flying has an automatic cutoff that if it goes upside down, the engine stops. But these things weren't challenged at the time, and I've always found that really odd, because, you know, as you refer to in your book, and you know, investigation and facts are key aspects here, and it often seems to me that skeptical excuses for certain incidents are often more ludicrous than the actual event that someone claims to see.
That's true. And Philip Klass sort of set the model for debunkers. Mm. Sometimes he was very astute, and he very carefully went through the data and picked things apart. But other times he would just say something that was ridiculous. It didn't have anything to do with anything. And and he'd act like he's an authority because he's against UFOs, just like, well, I don't believe in Santa Claus. Well, he'd say, I don't believe in UFOs and all that. And so he'd come up with some ridiculous explanation for things that just didn't cover what the observation was.
Yeah. Or the fact. Yeah. I think he was very good as well at kind of, you know, as you referred to, as we were discussing the comment from Hynek, he was very good in ignoring any evidence that may disprove or challenge his solutions.
Yes, and he set the pattern, and debunkers have been like that ever since. They don't pay any attention to the facts. They just say, well, this couldn't happen, therefore, and make up something that make up some scenario that doesn't even fit the what happened or the descriptions.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as you refer to in your book, your extensive experience in this field has developed over the years. So, how was it that you got invited into the Defense Intelligence Agency and sort of went along from that point? How did you get there?
Well, how I got there was I was trying to get into astronomy, and they didn't hire females.
Yeah.
But they did hire females in mapping, and they were different government agencies were doing astronomical mapping of like the moon and Mars and things back then. And so they did hire females for that. And so I got a job with the Aerospace Center in St. Louis as a cartographer, which is physical scientist rating, not already majored in astronomy. So I had the background for it. And then later I got a much higher security classification, went to the transferred to the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. And that was working with satellite photography. But I wanted to work on other planets, and I wound up working on Earth, which I wasn't as thrilled about.
Well, it's a start. It's a planet, at least. So, I mean, obviously, one of the other aspects is that you've used your own photos throughout your time. I mean, was there any issue at the time when those pictures were taken? Because obviously, I've not seen a collection of pictures of certain areas as extensive as what you've included in your book.
For example, you mean a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, hardly anybody gets on Wright-Patterson. It's a very, very, very secure area. And I was lucky because my employer sent me to Wright-Patterson several times, and I also had met the archivist for Wright-Patterson. And so I've been actually on base, which only about maybe three or four ufologists have actually been because it's so secure.
I mean, did you have to kind of repress yourself from getting a bit overexcited once you were in there? Or was it a case of, be all right? In regards to, you know, taking pictures and sort of, was there any kind of pushback to stop you, or was it, you're here, you've got authorization, fine?
I wasn't upfront about it exactly. Time my employer sent me to a meeting, and it was on base. And I didn't ask anybody. I just took a camera out and walked around the base and took pictures, and nobody stopped me. But I was very, very careful about it, and I didn't take pictures when anybody was watching me. But I had deniability because I hadn't asked, and nobody had said, don't do that. So I got a number of pictures, and I did that at other times. I think there was some back feedback because I put this on YouTube, so I have a record of it. But we had a local UFO newsletter, and I published a bunch of the pictures I'd taken on base. And I sent the it came out like about the first of the month, and about 3 days later, a jet plane dive-bombed my house. I mean, I live about 80 miles from Wright-Patterson. This is a military jet, a T-38, and it's a supersonic jet. And I heard this thing coming down, coming from the south, and suddenly I heard it dive bomb the house, and the whole house shook, and I couldn't believe it. And I got one camera loaded real fast, and it was just a regular camera, and took a picture. And then the airplane began to circle. And so I came back in and loaded a camcorder. And I live near a recreation area, and there happened to be a civilian pilot, stunt pilot, in the air at that time. And there were also model airplanes and RVs and RCs and things. Yeah. And So I got a picture of the jet that was that dive bombed the house. But I thought, how will I prove that? Well, anyway, I climbed over the fence, and my neighbors were standing out there with their mouths open, watching it too. And I said, what? And my neighbor said, the jet dive bombed your house. And so I had some confirmation too, and it was still circling, and I could get it and the pilot at the same time. And it had shaken the buildings right along there. And I kind of, this was a military jet. It was a supersonic jet. Mm. And the only place I could find in Ohio that was stationed was at Wright-Patterson. And I couldn't find any evidence that there were any air shows. And so I just kind of wondered if somebody tried to scare me off or something.
Yeah, it's certainly one way of getting your attention, I would suggest.
Well, it would have been illegal because I live beside a recreation area.
Mm.
Stunt pilots and remote-controlled aircraft and things like that. And so it was, it would have been highly illegal for them to have done that because it went real low over my house.
Oh, I mean, what year was that, Irina?
It was 1993.
Wow. So, I mean, it's, you know, some people would say that's coincidence, but I think, obviously, as you explained, the area you're in, the distance to travel, and the fact that you're in an area where that kind of action is banned would suggest that it wasn't coincidence whatsoever.
Yeah, somebody said it was coincidence that pilots do that all the time, but I've never heard of any pilot doing that any other time. And so I don't know for sure, but I was lucky enough to get it taped, and I put it on YouTube with, you know, the comments that maybe somebody was doing something deliberately.
Absolutely. I mean, growing up as a child, my school was actually on a RAF flight path.
Uh-huh.
So we used to see jets, I don't know, a couple of times a month fly over the school as part of their flyover. So I've probably seen jets on training exercises, I don't know, 100 times in my life as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw one do that, ever.
Yeah, I never saw anybody dive bomb a house. And I did have some confirmation on that.
Absolutely. Well, let's just be thankful their payload was empty by the sounds of it. Because,
yeah. You know. Yeah.
Goodness. So
we had something like that happen also in our, we had a small local group, and another two other people were interviewed on TV about UFOs. Mm. One of the people was a pilot, and he gave his address and phone number and things on the TV show. Well, not too long afterwards, like about half an hour, a helicopter came to his house and got in a firing position and circled the house three times and left. Mm. And that was pretty deliberate, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, this is a subject that constantly seems to pop up with people when they either issue a book or release a video or something these days, that there seems to be some kind of intimidation reaction that follows shortly after. I mean, are you still hearing of people suffering from these kinds of incidents, or do you think it's less common these days because of the fact that everybody's got a video camera in their pocket these days?
I don't know. I hear people, but I've never actually intensively investigated anybody except I was lucky enough to get a video of my own way back in 1993. Mm. And the helicopter pilot who I knew the aircraft pilot that reported the helicopter circling his house, his whole family saw it.
Yeah.
And I knew him well and knew that his family wouldn't be lying about it. But I've heard people say that, but I haven't investigated in detail.
Yeah, because I mean, it's always that, you know, that's a whole different, you know, strand you can follow down when you look at my first experience of the Men in Black phenomenon was obviously reading the Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of incidents seem to have disappeared from what that used to be the standard response for sort of UFO witnesses in the 50s and 60s, especially in the States. I mean, have you come across anything like that over recent years, or do you think that's just something else that's disappeared off the radar?
Well, I've heard people talk about that they're being intimidated and things like that, but I've just never investigated in detail to find out if there's anything. I mean, I just haven't investigated, actually. I'd like to, but I haven't.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that I've always found interesting, especially some of the more odd cases where people have these interactions with people that just don't act in a way that we are used to, or how a normal human interaction works, even if there's a disagreement or they're coming from a kind of authoritarian stance. There are some of those interactions that are very peculiar. So, yeah, I think it sounds like a worthy subject, really. It would be interesting to see if it's still going on.
Yeah, for example, I mentioned the coin helicopter instance. The coin was the pilot of the helicopter, and there were four other people in it. And after he had that experience of having the UFO over his helicopter and the green light and everything, well, he started receiving calls from, I can't remember, a government department. I can't remember the name of it. But from the government department, they were asking him what kind of dreams he had. And he said he dreamed something about a circle and some other things. And they would call him up about once a month and ask him what his dreams were, like they were investigating if he had had a mental interaction with him, or like an abduction or something. And it didn't interfere with his career at all. He went right ahead and got promotions and everything and just did fine. But it seemed like it might have been a part of the CIA. I just can't remember now. Yeah. But from the government, and they asked him, and they asked one of the co-pilot, I think, the same questions, as if they were psychoanalyzing him some way.
Yeah. So it's almost as if they were expecting a response.
Yeah. And I think they do that when they investigate abductions. And so far as known, that wasn't any form of abduction, even though there was a green light on them that seemed to levitate their helicopter, which is pretty weird.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about the other week on Facebook, we were talking about the Cash Landrum case, where obviously they ended up getting radiation poisoning from somewhere, which has never been admitted to. And obviously one of the key points of their experience was the fact that they saw the object, and then it was followed by a fleet of helicopters. Which everybody flatly denied, and obviously when they were taken, because they ended up being interviewed by the Air Force over their situation, as I'm sure you're fully aware. But when we were talking about it on our Facebook page, we actually had someone who lived in the area at the time, and she categorically stated she saw the same thing. And they've made a statement. It has never been mentioned. And I found that, because I've never heard a collaborative witness for the Cash Landrum incident at all. She was the first person I'd ever heard say, yeah, I live near there, I saw the same thing on the same night, and there was me and my family.
Well, the trouble is the ufologists aren't financed, and the government is, so if the government investigations and they don't tell anybody. Mm. Well, nobody finds out about those things. And a lot of times the ufologists don't have the resources to do a real thorough investigation.
Mm. Mm. I mean, in regards to that, obviously we've had the recent development that's been in the news all across the world about the US Navy's changing their reporting structure. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've said it's because pilots are fed up of being sidetracked or belittled over it. Do you think there's more to it? You know, like we were discussing earlier on, that there's a momentum coming and has been since Leslie Keene's article in the New York Times a couple of years ago. Do you think there's a connection there, or do you think it's just, as it's been alleged, pilot pressure that's caused it?
A group of ufologists got together and wrote a paper called A Forensic Analysis of Navy Carrier Strike Group 11's Encounter with an Anomalous Aerial Vehicle. Hmm. And went into all kinds of detail. They examined the radar reports and the observations from other people on the ships and everything, and they reported that to Congress people, and they did a real good, thorough report. Mm. And I think that's had an impact, because somebody did a real good report and got it to some people that some of the honchos in the government. Mm.
Yeah.
And that's caused the public to, I think the whole thing has caused the public to question what's going on. And that it's harder for the Navy to just ignore it and say, well, we're just unconcerned about these facts.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, even if it's just on a, you know, as you referred to earlier, even on a national security level, it deserves investigation regardless.
Yeah. And they're saying, they've said about all this, they don't actually say UFOs don't exist. What they say is they're no threat to national security. Well, that's baloney, because if they don't know what they are, they don't know whether they're a threat to national security or not. Mm. And when they say, you know, they just say that as a sort of a way of saying, well, they don't exist. And that doesn't even make sense. It's not logical.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. I mean, where is the evidence that they're a threat? I mean,
you don't know, because you don't know what they are. So how can you say that one way or the other?
Yeah. And if it's Venus in the night sky, then why would that be classed as a national security threat?
Yeah.
I mean, I just find it intriguing at the moment, because, you know, and obviously, you know, going back to Leslie Keene's article and the response from that, I know George Knapp last week, because I'd noticed over the last sort of 6 months there's been a kind of disinformation project, maybe, in regards to the Tic Tac video that was released, saying, oh, we don't know where it's come from and all that. And now George Knapp has finally confirmed that the Pentagon did release that footage.
It was, I think it was released from the DIA, which is I worked for. I had suspicions way back that the DIA was investigating UFOs.
Mm. I mean, what specifically kind of flagged the DIA up whilst you were there that you thought, I think there's something going on here? What was there a specific incident, Irina, that made you sort of raise your eyebrows and think, this isn't what we're being told?
Well, what happened was my sister and I had a sighting when I was working for it. I had one of those above top secret security clearances, the secured compartmental information type security clearance. And we'd seen a UFO, and you obviously didn't go around working with that kind of a clearance and everything, saying I saw a UFO. But anyway, my job at that time was Air Order of Battle, and it was identifying all flying crafts over a particular area of the Earth. And so I was involved in identifying flying objects. And I mentioned just the subject of UFOs. I didn't say I saw a UFO. I just made an abstract statement at work about UFOs, and I expected all my coworkers to laugh at me and shove me out of the room or something. But instead, they said that in their official jobs, that they had reported a UFO on the satellite photography that we were using and reporting on, and that the their higher ups had just rebuffed and debunked them just like nothing, with debunking that didn't make any sense at all. And that made me think that someplace higher up, that they knew something about it, because if they didn't, I think they would have been interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that we know governments from wherever you come from in the world, regardless of whether you consider yourself a patriot or a believer in your country and your government or wherever, we know all across the world governments have consistently lied and been proved to lie to us, especially in you know, times of war or conflict. And I often find it remarkable, but obviously not so much these days, that people just used to accept this kind of, yeah, it's all nonsense, none of it's true, everybody's seeing something, they're all making it up, everybody's an attention seeker. That was just taken on face value for so long.
Well, people tend to believe authorities, and even a lot of authority, how authorities got there or how they maintain their authority or anything else. They'll just believe, well, this person's authority, therefore I should believe him. Well, people that have UFO experiences, I think some of them will believe what they see as opposed to what authorities are saying, which doesn't do them any good socially. But they doubt authorities. But most people don't see UFOs, and so therefore they can listen to the authorities say, oh, there's nothing to it. I think having seen some yourself makes a difference. And also people that work closely with people that have had sightings, for example, Dr. Hynek, who started out as a big debunker and turned out to be one of the most pro-UFO people alive.
Yeah. Do you think that was because of his scientific background? He was used to analysing the data and making conclusions based on the evidence rather than as it was. I think it was the authorities' attitude to the incidents that basically made him think this isn't right.
Yeah, I think also he was in contact with scientists that had seen UFOs, and he was in contact with people that well, for example, pilots and things, your reputation depends on looking sane. And so it's very difficult to make reports. But people did. And I think that caused him to believe it, too, to think there was something to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels as well with Hynek, I think, with Stanton Friedman in regards to he kind of had a very similar journey personally in regards to how his interactions with the US government. And it was obviously the famous swamp gas case that convinced him that they simply weren't being truthful, both to the public and also to him, in a kind of, they'd got him involved under false pretenses.
Yeah, and he has all these documents that are redacted until he, you know, has documents that are practically all blacked out on certain subjects.
Well, that alone makes you question it. When anything's redacted, you know, the first question is why, and the second question is what aren't we supposed to know here then? I mean, I've often thought that releasing a redacted document is probably more troublesome than it's worth, because it simply just plays into the hands of anti-authoritarian organisations and people of that mindset.
Yeah, I mean, in our work, there were redactions because they don't want people to know I mean, the world to know how good their photography is, and they don't want people to know everybody and things like that. So they redact, but just redact so they can redact and say, well, this is a matter of security or something, when they can redact anything they want to and say that it may be perfectly good information about UFOs that they're hiding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so where do you think this momentum's going to lead us, Aria? Do you think that we're on the cusp of something groundbreaking being released? I mean, not that I'm saying, because the Tic Tac video is stunning, and I've still seen people say, "Oh, it's clearly a weather balloon." still to this day, a couple of weeks ago, on a message board on Facebook, which is aligned to the 14 Times, if you've ever heard of that magazine, they were discussing the Tic Tac video, and people were still saying, "Clearly a weather balloon."
I don't think that makes too much sense in what it did. I mean, it had an acceleration of about 13,000 G-forces, mm-hmm. and about 300,000 miles per hour.
Yeah, that's one hell of a weather balloon.
I know.
Maybe that's what they're keeping secret. They've got, you know, these super fast weather balloons that we're not aware of. Maybe that's the real reason. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. They have some really high-powered weather balloons. They don't want anybody to know about them.
Yeah. Somebody likes their weather in the US government. I think that's what we can take from that. So do you think the disinformation is still going on, even though we now know that this footage is coming from the US government?
Yeah, I think there's higher levels than the ATIP program that are hidden in the government, because I don't see how they could possibly have ignored all that.
Mm. I mean, obviously, I know in recent years we've had the arrival of the To the Stars Academy.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen numerous people point the finger of disinformation their way. What's your interpretation of because obviously I know they were quite instrumental in the Tic Tac video and in regards to that and Leslie Keane, but things seem to have gone quite quiet since that point from their end. What do you think in regards to that?
Well, I think for one thing that even when Project Blue Book was going on, it stopped. When it closed, the government could take UFO reports, and it was handled through something called JANAP 146 and Air Force 5511, where people that were in the military could report UFOs. Mm. And it was a General Bolander's memo had revealed that Blue Book was not taking reports from the public, but the military was still taking reports. And so the reports had to go someplace.
Yeah.
And so I think up in the military someplace, they were still up in the government someplace, they were still taking reports after Blue Book closed. And I think I would expect the program is still going on, but I think it's higher than, a lot higher than ATIP or any of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is intriguing because obviously, you know, like I say, as far as the public perception was concerned, Blue Book was closed in 1970, and it's as if no one bothered to collect them. But we now know they were all going somewhere. So do we know where these reports after Blue Book went?
I was just guessing that somewhere in the Pentagon, I don't know where. And I think the DIA would have, from what I work, my work in the DIA, they had specially trained satellites that photographed the ground and the airspace above it. Hmm. And what I worked on is actually still classified, I found out. But with today's technology, they would have a pretty good record of what's flying above the Earth, and they probably have a pretty good record of UFOs from satellite photography.
It's fascinating when you I mean, the problem I've always got with situations like this is once you find out that something's not true and it's been propagated by an authority, you know, I was always brought up to question everything regardless, because my basic respect for the world of science is based on the continual exploration in whichever field of science that you work in, to try and, you know, increase our knowledge and our understandings of a variety of phenomena. I mean, even if you look at, say, biology, we've discovered in the last 20 years three different species of humans that up until 2005, biologists were convinced you had humans and Neanderthals, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that that is not true, and we're expecting to find even more. So when it comes to subjects like this, I'm often frustrated because I don't understand the scientific reticence. Yes, I know there's obviously that attitude in regards to being labelled a crank or a kook in regards to this subject. But do you find that frustrating as someone with a scientific interest and background as yourself?
Yeah, and I went into detail on Special Report 14 in my book that this was a study by Mattel Memorial Institute by top scientists of UFO phenomena. And their results showed that there was less than one chance out of a billion that UFOs aren't real. They had taken the reports from Project Blue Book and gone over and looked over which ones were good and which ones were bad, and studied them and did a statistical analysis of the information, like the color and the number of objects in the observations and things like that, and compared them to things that were later identified, and came out with just a impossible high statistical chance probability that UFOs are real.
And yet people just go, oh, well, we'll go for the one in a billion. We'll take that one in a billion thing then. I mean, that even on a mathematical principle is ludicrous to think, oh, well, this clip. Even when you're faced with that level of data and analysis, it's a greater leap of faith to suggest that they don't exist than it is.
Well, that's what I've thought. That I thought that was probably the best scientific report that had ever been done on UFOs, because they're not leaving real definite evidence. But this was a scientific study done with scientific principles and good data saying that UFOs have a high probability of existing, that they're not just prosaic objects that are misidentified. And came out in several ways in the study.
Yeah. I mean, it must be very frustrating, I think, Irina, for people like yourself, that, you know, not only have you spent a life studying and working in and around this kind of subject, but obviously you've also had your own sighting. Did the sighting just cement that interest, that belief, that philosophy that there was more to this subject than you believed, or were you already convinced prior to your own sighting?
No, because my sister and I had a sighting that was way before we ever heard of UFOs. And so it didn't cement anything, because I didn't have a belief or any form of belief or knowledge or any idea of what UFOs were, and I never even heard of them. So our first experience, and it was years before we figured out that this probably was a UFO event.
Yeah.
It's when we were tiny children.
Yeah, it is perplexing in that regard, because there are, you know, numerous famous cases where people have had such interactions. I mean, going on your personal experience, you know what you saw. You have the intellect and the knowledge, credentials behind you to break it down and look at, you know, at all the potential possibilities. Do you often get frustrated when you see other reports that are completely dismissed out of hand based on, you know, perhaps, for example, one of the witnesses being a child?
Yeah, because I think my sister and I sort of, when I found out that this is probably a UFO thing, that was years and years and years after it happened. Well, it was the writings of Jenny Randalls from the UK.
Yes.
Who said that sometimes people, when they were children, see things like small UFOs. And then later they become repeaters and see other UFOs and like regular size UFOs and that sort of thing. Well, my sister and I fit in that pattern. But if the thing had just happened to me by myself, nobody would have believed me. Mm. And the only reason anybody believed me was because it happened to my sister too. Mm. And we weren't even discussing it, but we both saw the same thing. Mm. And so I had another witness. And also when we grew up, we had another sighting. And I think normally that would be dismissed. If I didn't have my sister, they would have said, you're imagining things. And it usually just happens to one person. Mm. So nobody believes them.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that kind of situation. As I'm sure you're aware, as you mentioned, Jenny Randalls. And Jenny's done a lot of work with probably one of our most infamous cases in the UK, which was with a police officer called Alan Godfrey.
I remember that.
Alan's just finally released his own book about the situation. He's someone I've always absolutely believed 100% in his experience, because he just clearly something happened to that gentleman. And he's what I've often found is the amount of medical conditions that nobody's ever heard of, that all of a sudden anybody that sees anything strange, everybody has these weird diseases or brain problems. And I just think, well, I'm amazed anybody in the world can get anything done, because apparently we're all seeing things and we've all got issues with our brains. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting, because they've always said just crazy people see UFOs. Well, that's one reason I wrote my other book, Inside the Lightning Ball, another book, and I mentioned that even though they say scientists don't see UFOs, just crazy people do, that lots of scientists actually report them, and some they've made a big issue about how astronomers never see UFOs. Well, they have actual surveys of astronomers, and they see more than other people do. But so, nobody knows it.
So they basically, well, that would just spear any argument against it. And do you think that's why it's just not common knowledge? Because, you know, if anybody looks, you know, astronomers look at the skies probably more than anybody else.
Uh-huh.
So why would you disregard that body of evidence?
Because nobody hears about it. People just hear astronomers don't see UFOs. Like it's a fact from debunkers such as Klassen people. Mm. They say astronomers don't see UFOs, or the government says it or something. And everybody believes it because they're authorities, even though the actual surveys have shown that astronomers see more UFOs than normal. I mean, there's not been very many surveys, but the surveys that are done, they've been anonymous because probably astronomers don't go around admitting it, you know.
I mean, which I find incredible, because you look at some of the things we've seen in the, you know, in the universe, you know, I think last week they discovered that Titan has this enormous great swathe of some kind of giant structure made of ice on it.
Uh-huh.
If you'd have told somebody 20 years ago that, they'd have said you were absolutely barmy. And I don't understand why intelligent people of a scientific mind are disregarded because they're clearly wrong. But that's their job. That's what they're doing. They're trying to find out and learn new things about the universe around us. Why would you do that? Because it's both counterintuitive and ludicrous.
Well, I can remember when I was a kid, you weren't even supposed to talk about space travel before they actually got rockets in. If anybody said that, it was like you were some kind of in the league with the devil or something. You were. And then finally they got rockets up and it became, you know, acceptable, and things like that. That when there's doesn't seem to be any experience, so people say, "Oh, this can't be. You're evil. You shouldn't talk about that until it happens."
Mm. Hey, dearie me. I mean, it's infuriating because, I mean, like you say, I mean, I've seen one thing that I can't explain, and I'm one of those people. I like to look at possibilities mm-hmm. and rule everything out, and being a massive fan of Sherlock Holmes, I've always worked on the mantra that when you've removed all the other possibilities, the conclusion is it has to be what you're left with. And I saw something, and I went through every other channel. I actually reported it to the British Meteorological Society, because I was convinced it couldn't be anything other than a comet or a meteor. And if it wasn't, then I'd seen something different. So I actually emailed them and said, I've seen this, da-da-da-da-da. Told them how long I'd watched it, what it looked like, whatever. Because I thought the only thing it can possibly be is a comet. And and they wrote back to me and said, you watched it for 20 minutes. Simply not possible. No comet or meteor would travel that slowly. And I thought, well, and I just thought, wow. So I looked at it. I tried to rule out every possibility. I was in a room. It was late at night. It was 2 a.m. in the morning. I was just about to go to bed. So I thought at first, is it car lights reflecting off a mirror and bouncing into the window? Is it a light? Is it something else? Is it coming? And so I moved around and the light stayed. You know what I mean? I tried those possibilities and then looked for a scientific explanation. And none of it tallied. So it could only be something unidentified. Now, I'm not saying I've seen an alien craft. All I've seen is I've seen an aerial phenomenon that I've never seen in my life. I've never seen anything since. But I looked at all the possible scientific explanations for what I could see, and none of them tally.
Well, the same thing here. And fortunately, nearly all my sightings have had other witnesses.
Good.
And if I didn't, I would have probably never said anything because I'd wonder if I was insane. But I did have other witnesses in a number of cases that were willing to write descriptions and draw pictures and everything else. And so that's one thing that gave me the courage to say something about it.
Yes. I think that it's one of those things. There seems to be like a selection of go-to excuses. I know one that seems to have developed over the last few years is that anybody who sees a UFO is clearly stoned, which I don't understand, because clearly if that's the case, there's quite a lot of people in America who have been smoking marijuana for quite a long time and nobody seems to know about it. But I just find it ridiculous how these dismissive theories gain traction when there's, you know, you're talking about professional people and they just seem, it's a one size fits all, Irina.
I know. And I think that's what convinced a number of people such as Hynek that these are not crazy people. These are people that are responsible. They're in responsible positions. They would get in trouble for reporting a UFO, and they still report it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be to be tarred with that kind of brush is, you know, it's also, you know, like as we've referred to, and I think whenever you discuss anything, I don't like the term fringe, but anything that's not a mainstream subject, such as ufology, cryptozoology, paranormal, it seems that there is this box of excuses that comes out every time for anything. And I just wonder just how deep this box of excuses is, because it seems that everything has a dismissive explanation, when often there is no scientific basis or evidence to support that theory.
Well, the thing is, as science evolves, so do your ideas of what's possible. Mm. And in my book, Inside the Lightning Ball, I started out by using lightning balls, ball lightning, to compare to UFO experiences, and saying that ball lightning is a prosaic phenomena.
Yep.
And UFOs are anomalous. Well, as I studied more about ball lightning, there's a lot of unknowns about ball lightning too. And so it was also mysterious. And so I didn't quite do that the way I wanted to. But it wasn't accepted by, it's still not accepted by a lot of people, but it wasn't accepted until fairly recently that ball lightning can exist, even though there are reports of people seeing it way, 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 way back in history. Mm-hmm. The scientists said, well, we can't put it in a cage and examine it, therefore it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And the same for meteorites. Nobody believed that rocks could fall from the sky until fairly recently in history.
Yeah.
And the only reason they decided they could was due to the chemical analysis of meteorites.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is really quite interesting. I was reading an article about the history of meteors, and it is hilarious, the excuses that came up for them when they sort of started being discovered in the sort of 18th century. And obviously, you know, you're talking about 200 years ago, but sometimes you hear things and see things, and you just think, have we not learnt anything in the last 300 years of education and of science and of knowledge?
Yeah, and the thing is, if you have something that's not repeatable and the scientists can't get it in the lab, well, then they're saying, well, this doesn't exist. Well, not everything's repeatable. Not everything's under human control. There may be all kinds of things, like most of reality, that scientists can't do controlled experiments on.
Yeah, I think often, you know, when we're talking about things like meteors and stuff like that, it takes a cataclysmic event often to kind of just basically prove beyond all reasonable doubt. You know, you look at Tunguska for a prime example. Another one is freak waves, which were dismissed for generations of scientists because all sailors tell fibs. It would seem to be the general answer to those things. And it was only when they had recorded incidents that they just... But I often think, what do these scientists who've spent their entire life saying, no, 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 and then something happens... It's as if they've never been wrong. It's as though everybody that disagreed with it disappears, and now everybody follows that trend. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. And that's interesting, because it'd be interesting if a lot of those things happened to the debunking scientists.
Yeah, I think sometimes some of them would still deny it, even if an alien popped out and bopped them on the end of the nose, some of them. Because
yeah.
I think for some people, it often makes me laugh that I certain disciplines seem to have become as dogmatic as religion. It's gone beyond knowledge to now just becoming a belief system, and that's it. There is nothing. You will occasionally hear scientists that say we know everything there is to know, which I just find gobsmackingly ignorant. Do you know what I mean? Because that we base all our knowledge on our experience on Earth and the experimentation and the scientific knowledge and development that we've built, you know, going back to the days of the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and so on. And I find it incredible that we're still projecting this arrogance out into space, a whole galaxy of unknowns, but we know how everything works because that's how it works on Earth.
What gets me is people say we're the only intelligent life in the universe. Well, maybe from our, we are, we haven't been very far out in the universe and don't know too much about even ourselves and our own planet.
Yeah, and I would suggest that we are not the only intelligent species on this planet either.
Yeah.
And I think we learn more and more as we go on. I mean, that in itself is quite an arrogant statement to believe. But then again, it's that, well, do you put humanity above any other life form on this planet? Because clearly we know that there are species of animal that are supremely intelligent.
And if it depended on survival, we wouldn't, like one-celled animals and things like that would survive a lot better in a catastrophe than we would.
Very much so. So for you going forwards now, what have you got planned? How have you got an idea of where you go on from this book, or have you got something in the pipeline that you're currently working on, Irina?
Yes, I was helping some people in the Pascagoula investigation, and we found and other witnesses, which is great, but also I had been investigating what happened during that time frame from way back, and so I've written a book on that may come out next year on a lot of other things that happened at that same time that people don't know about.
Fabulous. Well, I really look forward to that because that case is one that's always really intrigued me my entire life, you know, along with, like I said, the Alan Godfrey case, Travis Walton's another one. I just find Pascagoula, it's compelling.
It sure is, and I've talked to some of the people and things and talked to the other witnesses, and a lot of them were like, you talked about that they didn't say anything, and then they're older, retired, and that sort of thing, and coming forth and saying, yeah, we saw something at the same time he did, but nobody talked about it.
Yeah. I think people get to a certain age, Irina, and they just think, what the hell? What have I got to lose? I've retired now, bugger it. Oh, well, listen, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Love the book. I think it's a fantastic read. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's excellent, and all power to you for writing it. I think the one thing I'll have to say about the book is, and I'm going to quote you here if you don't mind, is that as you state in the book, unlike other investigators, my co-investigators and I not only probed but worked in some of the most crucial organisations and facilities that conducted government UFO research. And that, for me, elevates your book to another level. Congratulations. Well, it's a fantastic read.
Thank you so much. And I was very lucky I got to work for those.
Yes. And we were lucky as well, reading your book as well, my love. So listen, what else is up for you? You got any conferences coming up? Where can people find your work, your book?
My book, I've written three books, Inside the Lightning Ball, Sacred Corridors, and UFOs Today. They're on my website. My website is irinascott.com, and it should pop up if you just write Irina Scott in the computer. And all you have to do is click on the pictures of the books, and it takes you right to Amazon.com where you can order them. And I'll be giving a talk at the MUFON annual meeting this year in July, and one in the Phoenix group in July also, and another one in November in Virginia.
Oh, fantastic. Phoenix, there's a name that conjures. That's a whole different thing. I mean, the Phoenix lights just still blows me away today. That's that situation. And you've set me off again now. Well, listen, thank you again. It's been an absolute pleasure to spend some time talking to you today. I hope we'll speak again in the future. I wish you all power of success with the book. So thank you once again for your time today, Irina.
Well, thank you very much for having me and for this very fine podcast.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you. You take care. Look after yourself. We'll speak again.
Okay.